All right, guys, before we jump in, I want to tell you real quick about the 0 to 100 Elite Mastermind. This is our own high-level group for serious real estate investors looking to scale fast. Inside, we share deals, strategies, and we build real relationships all to grow our cash flow portfolios. And you know what? Most members actually add 10-plus units in their first year. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to our podcast guests for direct Q&A. If you're chasing time freedom through real estate, check it out at 0to100tribe.com. That's Z-E-R-O-T-O, the number 100, tribe.com. Now, enjoy the show.
Being on some chips, we go 0 to 100 real quick.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast. I'm Travis Dillard, and we're all about scaling a cash flow real estate portfolio from zero to over 100 units and achieving your retirement number one, or R1. That's where passive income from real estate replaces your day job and gives you complete time freedom, which is the new currency of the rich.
I'm Mitchell England, and I'm thrilled to have you on board. With our combined real estate holdings valued over $100 million, learn from us and others who've achieved time freedom through cash flow real estate.
This is Gabriel Hamill. Here at 0 to 100, you will not hear us talk about house flipping, spec homes, wholesaling, or land banking. We are only about achieving time freedom through buying and holding cash flow real estate. So remember, if R1 is the destination, real estate is the vehicle, and cash flow is the gas. Now go out there and buy some cash flow real estate.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast show, the show where we dive deep into the world of real estate investing and entrepreneurship. With your hosts, Mitchell England, Travis Dillard, and myself, Gabriel Hamill. Today, we have a special guest joining us, Mr. Ryan Bowden, a seasoned real estate investor and entrepreneur hailing from the vibrant city of New Orleans, Louisiana. Travis, in case you did not know that, or Mitch.
No, that was Mitch that didn't know it.
I knew where he's from.
All right. Ryan transitioned from a W-2 role as internal auditor for the oil and gas company in Houston, Texas, to become a powerhouse in the real estate world. Faced with the challenges of unemployment during the 2008 economic downturn, Ryan seized the opportunity to embark on a remarkable journey in real estate investing. From humble beginnings, Ryan grew his portfolio to approximately 1,500 multifamily units across three states. But it doesn't stop there. Despite the challenges presented by the COVID-19 pandemic, I don't know what that is, by the way, so maybe we'll dig into that. Shifting to exclusively investing in retail triple net properties in an impressive 18-month period. Throughout Ryan's journey, he has mastered the art of creative financing, utilizing techniques such as seller financing, commissions, and seller credits to navigate deals of varying sizes with finesse. So join me in welcoming Ryan Bowden to the 0 to 100 podcast show.
And for the record, as you know, before we went live on the recording, I knew you were hailing from New Orleans, by the way. I love New Orleans. Mitch didn't know. He was ill prepared.
I was just trying to start conversation and be.
So Ryan, let's dig into this. Let's go back even before you were in the oil and gas industry in Texas. How'd you get into that position? What was your childhood like? Were you always interested in real estate investing? Let's kind of go back to Little Ryan.
Little Ryan grew up in Lake Charles, Louisiana, small town on the border of Texas, Louisiana. Parents were in the jewelry business. You know, my father took after my grandfather. And I guess I was predisposed to take that over. So I went to college in a local town in Lake Charles, went to McNeese, got my accounting degree, got my master's. And yeah, I was going to do the jewelry thing. And after doing it for 3 months, I'm like, this is not for me at all.
Counting or being an entrepreneur in the jewelry business, taking over the family business?
Well, you know, it wasn't much of a entrepreneurial role. It was, you know, do all the grunt work kind of stuff, which I guess any hard-headed young 20-year-old doesn't want to do. But, you know, it just wasn't for me. And I didn't really see the vision of it. You know, they were very, very, very mom and pop. And they were by the books. They were, you know, everything super the right way. But I didn't see it being big enough for me. And I didn't really like it. So it was probably 24, 23, something like that. And so I decided to use all the education I went to school for and get into accounting and did basic tax stuff for a few months. And that sucked. So then I tried audit because I saw that there was a lot of opportunity to travel. If I went to Houston with the oil and gas company, so I went there and I traveled everywhere, you know, Europe, Asia, Middle East, South America. And I was like, it kept me excited until the market crashed and they laid me off.
I got to tell you, just to make a quick comment on the tax stuff, Mitch and I, we own a little private equity company that invests in real estate. I hate tax. I can't even stand talking to my CPA. I couldn't imagine actually being one. So was it just like you did that? Were you working in private practice? Were you doing that for working for a larger company and then you quit? Or were you, did you just move positions within the company that you're at?
Yes. So I was working for a medium-sized CPA firm, and I was just doing taxes, for the 3-4 months. And then I would do a tiny bit of audit after that. But yeah, man, I was just sitting in front of the computer going through hundreds of tax returns. Yeah, it was just not for me. I mean, I'm too hyperactive to sit down in there and just grind on my computer all day. But, in hindsight, it has helped me able to go through financials really quick. Right. I can digest a P&L in about a minute. So that's a blessing in disguise. But I went, to a billion-dollar oil and gas company and completely different universes.
So then 2008, you laid off. So I'm assuming you were making pretty good money. You were doing your thing. And in 2008, they just cut you and said, we're done. Good luck. Or what'd that look like?
I think it was a perfect excuse for them to lay me off because I wasn't very good at it. I just wasn't, what's funny is after I got laid off, I'm like, okay, I need to find me another audit job. And I applied for this other company, which was a casino in Lake Charles. I've never told anybody this. So I was in my second round of interviews and they started asking me a bunch of guidelines and practical steps and whatever, all that stuff. They started asking me very specific audit principles. I had no idea what they were asking me.
Was this like financial audits, like GAAP accounting, like making sure that books adhere to GAAP financial statements, or like were you like an analyst? Like explain
audit. Yeah, so what I would do mostly when I would travel is I would go to a construction site in wherever, in Peru or whatever, and then I would go see what fixed assets we have, what we still had there in the condition, and how many we had, and look up payroll and timestamps and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't super into the weeds of the financials per se, but this job was needing that. And I had no freaking idea.
Man, if I was in my 20s traveling the world, I would suck at whatever I was doing because I'd be too busy partying probably and enjoying myself than focusing on payroll and timestamps and things like that.
And dude, whenever I was there is whenever gas was $4 a gallon, they were all making just insane money. I mean, I remember it so vividly. I was 23 or 24 and I got this job oh, we're sending you to Dubai. This is when Dubai was just kind of starting off. We're sending you first class in the Emirates jet.
Oh my gosh.
What is going on?
So I've done it. It's incredible. I didn't want to get off the plane. I was just keep me on this plane. They're so nice.
Oh my God. Dude, they picked me up in a limousine. I was there for 3 weeks on my first trip. So
that's amazing.
What was your mindset there? Prior to applying for other jobs and before, building your real estate portfolio, what was your mindset like when they're like, hey, we don't need you anymore?
So they laid off a few people before me. So it wasn't like I was the first one to go. I'm surprised I wasn't. But you know what happened? So I was on my second trip to Dubai. And
then you're in coach and you're something's wrong.
The recession has kicked in. They're freaking out. They're like, Ryan, we need you to fly coach. I told him, I was like, no, I don't want to fly coach. Oh,
you
my God.
With those people.
Dude, it was a 17-hour flight, man. It's a long freaking nonstop. Not delay here. No, just go. Oh, yeah. And so I told him no. Okay, so that was pissed. That was probably my first ex. And then we had a big dinner with the European CEO, CEO, the CFO, probably a 40-person dinner. We meet up. We're having drinks. I'm jet lagged. So bad. Long story short, I pass out at the dinner table with all the executives. So,
oh, wow.
They think you're drunk.
I don't think that went over very well. I had probably 2 or 3 drinks. Just so jet lagged, dude.
Oh my gosh.
Mitch does that all the time. It's embarrassing and obnoxious.
It's not true. It's happened a couple times, but it's not all the time.
Mitch might do that on this podcast recording. It's very possible.
Well, I had leftover wine. I had to finish it.
No, it's just because he's going to go comatose on us. Go comatose, baby. Okay, so you pass out, and then did they fire you there, or they wait for you to get home?
So I finished my 3 weeks there. I get home, go to work the next day or 2 days, whatever. and I'm checking my business credit card, you know, to see how much I've charged or get my reimbursement or whatever I was doing. Like, oh, sir, your card has been declined. Oh, so I emailed my boss. I'm like, hey, man, if y'all are going to do anything with me, please do as soon as you can, because I'm about to sign a new lease and this and that. And an hour later, HR calls me in.
Oh, my gosh.
So It was a unique experience.
So tell us about your mindset. Like, we're all taught, right? We're all taught go to school, get a great education, which you did, by the way. You got a master's in accounting. You're traveling the world. You're flying first class, and then you get canned. Like, where's your mindset? Are you like, that wasn't for me, I'm glad that happened? Or, oh my gosh, that was my life, and now what do I do? Was there like self-esteem issues? Like, 'cause we're all told this is the path. And then when something happens like that, not to put words in your mouth, but like, we all start to go, wow, like, I was an expense on a profit and loss statement, and yep, I got whacked. Like, I know in my past, like, I don't ever want to be in that position again. I want to have control over it. But like, what was your mindset as 20 some year old Ryan, who just probably lost what some would consider somewhat of a dream job?
I think I was a little bit prepared of something, especially seeing other friends get laid off and this and that. I had some reserves. I mean, I was making like 60 grand a year, so I wasn't making crazy. I mean, I was like, you know, base level, you know, and obviously you got taxed the crap out of it. And I lived in the funnest part of Houston, so my rent was crazy high. But yeah, my mindset was to find another job. And, you know, after I went for the interview for the second job that I had no idea how to answer it, I'm like, okay, I can't get a job like this again. I got to find something that I like. So my uncle had a real estate company. I'm like, I'm going to go for real estate. 'Cause my dad owned a few buildings. My uncle was in real estate. He owned some stuff. I'm like, let's go for that. So that was the turning point to get out of the accounting world.
You didn't have like a ton of money saved up at this point, I'm guessing, because you said you're paying high rent. Did you have a lot of reserves to get started, or were you just walking in?
No, I probably had 15, 20 grand maybe.
Got it. Okay. I want to make that distinction, because it's like, we'll talk about the portfolio you built, and I want to hear how you did this, because a lot of people are like, well, I can't go build a portfolio because I don't have the money. And with, you know, you and me and Travis and Gabe included, started with very little. So you jumped into real estate, or you started working with your uncle, it sounds like, the next thing.
I had a little brokerage firm in Lake Charles. Very, very, very old school as well. Like, old school, like, put a sign in the yard and this is how I'm going to sell it. Kind of old school, you know?
Yeah.
But I got my license and I was doing commercial leases, and I really, really liked it. I mean, I cold called everybody. I don't care. And I got like 30 or 40 listings. It was awesome. And, but it sucked there. Fast forward probably 6 months or a year. I ended up saying, hey, I want to buy something. So I ended up finding these two fourplexes in Lake Charles. I borrow 40 grand from my parents, and I bought my first two properties, two fourplexes that are probably 100 years old that were occupied and really beat up. And that was the start of the journey.
Did you finance it with bank financing?
Yeah. And, okay. They were, $100,000 each. And I put down 40 grand my parents gave me.
So these are old buildings. First of all, you have no capital buying 100-year-old buildings. So that's, I want to get into that. But like, so this is an 08, did you say? 09?
So I bought my first piece in 2010.
So lending was still wobbly. Lending was still nasty. Yeah. So tell me about your, because I remember I'd bought like a single family house with the VA loan. I'd done some stuff prior. Actually, I did some flips or some spec houses. And I think Gabe had this. We're like, oh, you have a pulse. Oh my gosh, that's neat. You have teeth. We'll lend you, you know, $500,000 or whatever the case is. Right. And so you're thinking you're just a genius. And then 08 hits, or for me, 08, 09 hits, and everything freezes up. Banks, all of a sudden, they're not lending to anybody. So 2010, like, what did that look like? Did you have the income? Like, how did you make that happen with a bank?
I found a super local bank, and, you know, that knew my parents and blah, blah, blah. My parents weren't super rich or anything like that, but, you know, the bank liked the property. You know, they lent pretty much off the down payment and the cash flow of the property. So my secondary source of repayment was very minimal in the deal.
Was it a residential loan or was it a commercial loan? Would they treat it as commercial, two residential properties, because it's for you? Okay, so they bundled as like a portfolio package. And for those of you listening, remember, like, commercial lending, they put more weight on the property itself. Because like, Ryan's a young guy, no offense to you, but you're probably a young guy, you have no experience in managing a property. it helps having the connections and some notoriety maybe with your family. But at the end of the day, they're looking at the assets that they're lending against. They're looking at the collateral and the cash flow that those assets generate, right? So, and these sounds like these are producing decent amount of cash flow. The bank was comfortable with it.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a dollar amount. I mean, it priced for, you know, 20-30% higher. It wasn't horrible kind of thing. So
I want to like ask you what your mindset was on this as well, because like, were you like, look, I want to go do this more. I want to go build a big portfolio. Or was it like more like, let's just hold, I mean, did you have big goals and aspirations after you bought this first property? Or was it like, how did that go?
You know, it's, and I look back upon this and think about from time to time, but like, I never read any real estate books, anything like that. I just winged it. And my mindset was, I know I can do this kind of a thing. You know, I had a lot of determination, a lot of persistence, a lot of piss and vinegar.
I love that.
Yeah, dude. I mean, just, I may fail, but I'm not going to like have like little fall downs here and there, but sure. I'm not going to just collapse and die. I'm going to keep on fighting no matter what.
I'm going to tie this back to something you said earlier. You said when the jewelry business, it wasn't big enough for you. So when you bought these 8 units, I think I'm going to elaborate on Mitch's question, but just a lot better. So like you buy 8 units. You mentioned not big enough with the jewelry store earlier. Were you like, did you think you're going to go to 1500 units? Were you like, hell yeah, I'm going to grow a massive portfolio? Or was it, I'm going to just buy an 8-plex and see what happens?
Yeah. Option number two. 1500, okay. That was definitely not on my horizon. I didn't think I was going to be buying, you know, 200 unit complexes or anything like that. I mean, I bought the 8 and I fixed them up and I, you know, rent them all out and I bumped a little bit of rent. And then I don't know if the rate dropped or whatever, I cashed out, refied, and then started looking on the market, what was available. And I found maybe a 12 unit. And I saw it and this, and, you know, I saw the pricing and the rents. I'm like, nah, I can do this. So I did a partial owner finance and a partial commission and a partial this. And I put down like 20 grand to buy it. And
did you get all your money back out of the first deal, the 40 grand?
And
did you have to pay your parents back on that? Or did you keep it and were able to keep rolling that equity, that capital into subsequent deals?
I was paying them interest and they were okay with me.
Got it. Letting it ride. Again, takeaway there. We talk about this in the tribe quite a bit. The velocity of capital, basically bird 8 units, the buy, rehab, you know,
yes,
rent, refinance. So fixing them up, raise rents. And when you make the profitability of the asset better, it increases the value. If you, for every annual dollar that you drop to the bottom line, you increase the value 10 to 20 times. Banks come in, give you more money. Now you can pull your capital back out. You still own the 8-plex, right? You didn't sell it. So you still own the 8-plex. And now you use that money to go buy a 12-plex. Is that, did I capture that correctly?
That's right.
And how did the 12-plex work out for you?
Great. I had metal roofs, cinder block walls. And, you know, I was able, you know, his P&L, which is what he sold the property off, he's just expensing everything through it. You know, like crazy management fees. And so I cleaned up the P&L. Sent the new P&L to the bank and the appraiser, and it appraised for, you know, 70, 80, 90 grand more, and I pulled some more money out.
Did you buy it though, based on his net operating income? Did you buy it based on all his crap expenses that he was running through the properties, or did you normalize it and then give him a value based on that, a revised net operating income without all the expenses loaded up?
Yeah, no, I bought it pretty close off of what he was running it as.
Yeah. So then you back all those expenses out again, just like raising rents has the same effect by reducing expenses. So We were just talking about it on the Elite call earlier. Someone has an 84% expense ratio on a mobile home park. And we're like, she's going to pass. And we're like, well, dig in. Like, why? Yep. Oh, there's interest. There's depreciation. There's a bunch of crap that's in there. And some sellers aren't sophisticated enough, and or they're brokers that are residential brokers that shouldn't be selling commercial properties, don't understand that.
Yep.
So
That situation was all this. It was this little old lady that was the broker. And, you know, again, it was still the kind of the Wild West in 2010, 2011, 12, you know, with real estate. There was not a ton of sophisticated buyers, especially at this price point. Sure, there were for the, you know, big groups and all that kind of stuff. But for this type of property and this type of market, yeah, it was still all mom and pop kind of stuff going on.
Ryan, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and really dig into the scale side of things. And one thing we talk about at 0 to 100 a lot is how to scale. And I know that you've moved on from multifamily, and I believe most, if not all, your portfolio now is triple net retail, correct?
Yes.
So, but going back from, you bought the 8 unit, you bought the 12 unit, but at one point you had scaled your portfolio to 1500 units. So that's a lot more than, you know, 0 to 100. That's zero. You started at zero, just like everybody else, and you scaled to a 1500 unit portfolio. And I know there's, you know, a decade and a half of stories within stories, but I'd like to dig a little bit in, like, what did that look like? You went from 8 units to 12 units. But in a very pretty short period of time, you ended up with 1500 units. Yep. How did you do it? What was your mindset around that? What were some things you implemented? What were the relationships you built? What were the assets you were buying? Were these, you know, were you sticking to 8 unit and 12 unit type properties, or were you buying, you know, multi-hundred unit complexes at a time? And at what point, you know, as we get further down the story, at what point did you decide to sell all your multifamily and change asset classes?
First couple of years it was on me. So I went from 8 to 12 to 16 to 24. Then I bought an 8, and I think I bought another 8. So I had about 72, 80 units in Lake Charles, 100%. I'm like, I'm great, man. I'm making $15,000 a month in cash flow. I got one employee. I work a little bit at the jewelry store. I'm going to make it. It'll be great. Then I got married to a girl
New
Orleans. And she had a successful a fitness franchise in New Orleans, and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna sell it all, move to New Orleans, and I'll rebuild. So I went to 72 or 80, then went back down to zero. I sold everything like Charles, and so I moved to New Orleans. I have, I don't know, handful, you know, few $100,000 in the bank. My wife has a good business, and she has some money, and she has really good tax returns. And so together with her tax returns and my cash, we buy a 40 unit. Great, beautiful 40-unit Baton Rouge. That goes like a freaking grand slam. And I get real creative with that one. I put actually no money down to buy that one.
Seller financing?
Seller credit. You needed a new roof, a new parking lot. It was $1 million building. And he's gave me $200,000 as a credit instead of fixing it. And the bank treated that as cash.
Wow. Again, that's banking in a time where lending was tight, man. Like,
yeah.
I saw like the rules changed overnight. So kudos to you. And would your strategy there be working with local banks, small banks, credit unions that understand the area, comfortable with the asset? Is that the strategy there? Yeah.
Yeah, right there it was. And I still use regional banks now as much as I can. And then, you know, a lot of these apartments over the next couple of years, I refinanced to CMBS and Fannie, and that's a whole different story. But we bought that 40 unit. I mean, that was such a good property. I mean, I sold it to my parents, and that was some cash flow for them for like 2 or 3 years. And, you know, so that was a grand slam for me. So the next property was a 72 Baton Rouge, got for a killer deal. And at that point, the next opportunity was a 180 unit, 3-property portfolio.
You're still not taking on investors. You're not syndicating. You're just like getting creative with sellers, low to no money down.
Yep.
Just trying to let that couple hundred grand stretch as far as it can to scale.
And where are you getting these deals? Are you cold calling, or are you going direct seller? Are you building, you know, broker relationships, or both?
The market and broker relationships at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have 112 units, I think it was, you know, plus or minus a few. And 180 unit portfolio pops up right across the street from my 72 units. Now I bring on a partner, and I bring on one of my best friends. You know, we've been talking for years on it. And so I brought him on. We're 50-50 partners. We bought the 180 unit, brought us up to, was that almost 300 units?
When you got to the 122 units before you moved to the 180, what was your cash flow? Do you remember? And was it covering your living expenses? Could you essentially be financially free, or was it, do you have more to go?
Sure, I was making probably close to 20 grand a month in cash flow. Yeah, I think me and my wife could have lived off of that. But again, she had a really successful business. That was probably the majority of our income. But we were just rolling into the next property, you know?
When you partnered on the 180, what did that partnership look like? Was he the capital provider and you were the operator? Or were you both capital providers? Were you joint ventured on it? Were you both operating it collectively?
He was majority capital, and he wanted to be involved, but I'm like, dude, I don't want you to be involved. I don't want anybody. I want to do it my way.
I say that to Mitch every day. Dude, back up. Get it? I don't want you involved.
I don't see that. Here
he is. Every day he shows up. He's like a cockroach. He just doesn't go away.
Well, no, yeah. Well, you know, I use him to bounce ideas off of. I'm not going to say, hey, dude, we got a clog or we got tenant, you know, shot somebody. But, you know, it's like, hey, dude, we're with the restructure of the debt. Well, give me your thoughts. And he would just tear parts of it. He's really brilliant. And that was his level of involvement. And he lived in Dallas, too, I think.
You brought the deal. You brought the knowledge. You brought the operations. He brought the majority of the capital. Did you have any employees, or were you like the asset manager managing? Were there like third-party property managers that you were managing yourself? Did you have an asset manager? Like, what did that look like? That's now you're up to, you know, 300 units. So
yeah, man, I went through probably three or four property managers, and every time they almost like ruined me. So
oh, weird. Yeah, I know that story. Yeah,
these are class C properties, dude. I mean, these aren't like you know. I'm not rent to doctors and lawyers and stuff like that. I'm rent to, you know, tough, you know, classy people. I by far had the best system and the least amount of stress when I self-managed. So I self-managed up to about 900 units.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
That is awesome.
So I probably had, I don't know, 30, 40 employees.
That's actually really interesting. I wonder if good third-party property managers exist for Class C apartments. Do you know them? Do they? Gabe and I are dealing with Class C apartments in Oklahoma City that we got roped into as investors, and now we had to take over. And I'm on my fifth property manager. Like, it's very, very difficult.
I just think it's so hard because they have such harder restrictions in regards to like insurance and hiring employees. Like, I hired a big group to manage my 1,500 units. And I mean, when COVID kicked in and nobody wanted to work, like they couldn't hire anybody that didn't have like a misdemeanor. I'm like, how are we going to hire anybody that doesn't have that? I mean, like,
there you go, Gabe. Side note, we need to build our own property management company for Oklahoma City and just build it in house. So you managed 900 units. Were they all in the same area? Like, are you able to do that because you could sort of like hub spoke, have a centralized operations team, and then take down properties? Or you said you were in three states, I guess. So did you have like regionals? I'm jumping ahead. Then I want to go back to find out how the hell you actually got to 900 units from 300.
No, I was, I was still spread out. I wasn't like in one city or anything like that. I just drove a lot. I had these couple people that were just my rock stars, right? And I'm like, all right, you live in Baton Rouge. Great. I'm moving you to Shreveport. Okay. Guess what? I'm moving you to Mississippi. Okay. We'll do it. So they let me sleep at night, and they were reliable.
Did you also manage other buildings, or was it your internal team was just your portfolio?
Just my stuff. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So back to 300 units. We know how you got to 122 using your own capital or using some creative seller credits, getting in low to no down. You partnered with somebody that had capital to get to 300 and some units. How did you go from 3 to 9 or to 15? Did you start raising more capital for more people? Was this all just you and your partner, or just you? Like, what did that look like? How did you scale?
Yeah, I think the next property was like a 40 unit across the street. So I don't know if we were at 350 or 400 units. I forgot exactly how many we had. But then we jumped about 5 hours north of Shreveport and we bought a 200 unit complex. Okay. So that put us to, let's say, 600 units. And then...
How did you buy that? Was that you and your partner?
Me and my partner.
Was that all you?
We straight up owner financed that. Straight up owner financed it. Through a lot of negotiations. We were going through a bank and blah, 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 blah. But we were able to set up a sweet, sweet deal for the 200 units. And then I bought 150 units probably 6 months later, probably a mile down the road from there.
And are you refinancing and rolling capital out of deals to put down? Are you partnering with more people with capital, or are you just using the wife's business, generating a lot of income? The reason I ask this is because a lot of people that listen to this podcast are like, they're like, wait, 900, like, oh, I bought 200 units and 300. He's like, I can't get a freaking duplex or a fourplex. Like, how does it go down to 800 units? A lot of podcasts, they just kind of glaze over it. Oh, great. I bought 200 and 300 and 400 and, you know, and rainbows and butterflies. Like, how did you do that? How did you go take down that extra 200 units?
I got really good talking with banks and knowing what they needed to hear, what they needed to see. And I'll give you a really good example. The biggest portfolio I bought was 280 units, small town, Mississippi, right? So I paid like, I don't know, something crazy. These are all, it was good looking buildings, but they're called LIHTC properties.
LIHTC, yep.
I paid like $20,000 a door for it, right? It appraised, local appraiser appraised for $21,000 a door. I'm like, all right, I know it's worth more than this. I call the CMBS lender out of
New York, and they use an appraiser out of Atlanta to come in. And they appraise it. They appraise it for $40,000 a door. Okay. I'm like, okay, that's pretty incredible. You're going to give me 75% on that. And I've only owned it for 3 months. Incredible. But I'm like, you know what? I'm going to call HUD. So I called HUD and a broker that does HUD. They sent an appraiser out of, I don't even know where he was out of. But anyways, he appraised it for $62,000 a door. And they were going to give me 80% money on that.
But you had already owned the property before you went out to find debt on it.
3 months.
Right. How did you buy it? How did you take it down?
The local bank.
The first time. So you put money down. They gave you what, 75% LTV or
like
60?
75, 80, something like that. Yeah.
Got it. And so then you basically got in. I love the appraisers out there that are like 20 to 60K door. Like, whoa, like there's no science to this. It's a total freaking joke. Sorry if there's appraisers listening out there, but like, so you were able to get all your money back out after you refinanced using HUD.
For all my deals and collecting money, I would just constantly be talking with my banks. I would structure all my loans, don't have any kind of prepayment penalty. So I would have a lot of flexibility. I know I would have to spend money on origination fees and extra title work. And I was okay to accept that. And it was okay because I was doing bigger deals. But yeah, dude, I'm constantly refinancing, constantly asking for lines, constantly just talk with my banks. Say, dude, I'm doing this. I need more money. I'm buying another property, blah, 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 blah. So one property I would like, because I was getting, at some point I was getting too much recourse debt. And they were like, Brian, you got too much recourse debt for how much cash you have and how much income you can. It's okay. So I took one property, 100 units, and I brought to Fannie Mae, went non-recourse, made them happy.
Really quick for those of you listening, recourse means if you don't pay the bank back, they can come take your house and all your personal assets. Non-recourse, great opportunities out there is where they can foreclose on the property, but they can't come take your personal assets unless they have bad boy carve outs, unless you turn out to be a criminal, you know, or fraudulent. But like, so I just wanted to clarify that. So you started moving these assets into non-recourse debt and Fannie Freddie type institutional debt.
Yeah. I mean, I brought as little as possible. You know, their terms were incredible, you know, 30 year AM and all that kind of stuff, and just made my cash look incredible. But on that 280, I did not go with HUD. I gave them 100 grand. I started the process. But after going through the process, it was so challenging and so much of a headache. And they wanted me to do so much work before they approved the loan. I'm like, man, I'm not going to do it. So I ended up just selling it, made some good money on it. So I don't want to keep it long term.
So you sold it?
I sold it.
Got it. Yep. So if you were to sum up your strategy on scaling to 1,500 units, it would be scrappy. Build relationships with banks, and it's relationship game, right? I mean, we talk about this all the time, relationships with brokers, relationship with lenders. There's a million and one different lending products out there, a million and one different lenders, all different types of appraisers. Like it's very real estate. People can make an obscene amount of money in real estate because it truly is an imperfect market. There's sellers that want out for whatever reason. They don't understand the value. You've got appraisers out there giving you 64K a door. I got an appraiser on my 200 units or 150 unit. I'm like, that's way too high, but I'll take it. Thank you. You know,
dude, that's such a good point. I mean, there has been times that I would call one branch at one bank and they would tell me no. I called another branch of the same bank, not on purpose or anything, and they approved the loan. So
that's
dude,
incredible. Yeah.
I don't tell Janice down the hall that you approved his loan.
Can you hand the phone to your buddy?
I mean, dude, I'm still used to calling 20, 30 banks on deals now, dude. I was like, this is where I gotta have. And if I hear 29 no's and one yes, then I got my yes.
You need one. Just like a buyer. If you're selling,
I love that. And I like listening to you, I'm like, I mean, we're always like 0 to 100. We're always trying to really, you know, break like the ceiling where it's like most investors stay at like 5-10 units. And then we talk to guys like you who go to 1,500, which is incredible. So I'm like, I'm listening to you and I'm like, what is it? What's the sauce? Obviously you're amazing, the numbers, but also just like the resilience. Like you're like, no, 29 times, 30 or 100 times, whatever. Anyway, I just recognize that in you, and I recognize that in Travis and Gabe as well. Like, it's just you just never stop.
Well, what did Daniel say? We had Daniel on the call. Your buddy Daniel are on the show. He's like, just wake up and be a savage every day.
Just be a savage. You just be savage. Yeah. You just never stop. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what I hear, Ryan, you do a lot of the things that a lot of people just are not willing to do. Even other real estate investors, when we talk a lot about relationships, you know, relationships have been a huge important piece of building my portfolio, just having conversations with people. But you also really illustrate, like, you're like, I called 50 banks, or I actually called the same bank and spoke to a different lender. A lot of people hear no once and they stop, or they make a couple calls and they're like, these three banks said no, but it's not, you know, sometimes it is the 30th bank or the 40th bank or banker, right? It's where you get that success. So you have a strong desire to make it happen regardless of the no's.
Well, and those 50 no's or those 47 no's like weren't for nothing. Like, you're building rapport, right? Maybe they didn't lend on that particular asset class, but they were impressed with your knowledge. You find out what they like. Like, Dylan is one of our elites right before this call. He said he called 50 banks, got 47 no's, but I think he ended up doing like hard money and private financing and stuff. But anyway, like, here's a guy that's like just as savage, just as like getting after it. Like, you know, for every no, you're closer to a yes, which Mitch says that, which is one of the smarter things Mitch has said, which is very few. Yeah, cold calling.
This is bullying at its best right here.
Yeah, when he cold calls somebody, he says like, for every no I get, I'm closer to my yes. And what's each no worth to you? So I love that.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, you're building relationships, you know, and real estate's a long game, you know. I was talking to this one bank for probably 8 years, and I always knew they were super conservative. Probably never get a deal with them. And I'd follow up with them every 6 months. And like 6 months ago, they're like, oh yeah, we'll give you $500,000 unsecured line of credit. I'm like, okay, what do you need from it? Oh, nothing. Just come sign some papers. I'm like, okay, I'll be there in a few minutes.
At some point you got up to these 1500 units and you decided, hey, I'm done with multifamily. What conclusion did you come to that made you decide to sell your entire portfolio and move into triple net retail?
I'll try to condense as best as I can, but COVID was a huge aspect of it. The eviction ban was a huge aspect of it. And the icing on the cake was I had 200 units in the south of Texas, right off the Gulf Coast, and it got smacked by a hurricane. I had 30 or 40 trees fall down. Only one of the 30 or 40 touched a building. So none of them were covered. And then it uprooted my plumbing system. So, blah, it was horrible. And also during this time, I could see that the cap rates were compressing in the multifamily, right? I saw rates were dropping. And then I see all these institutional grade, beautiful looking retail buildings just skyrocketing the cap rates because they're going to shut down the businesses. But the places where I was buying, they were not shutting down at all. They were thriving. Because my first property I bought when I made the switch was a building in Alabama. It was a Tractor Supply, Planet Fitness, and a bargain hunt. New roofs, new electrical, new HVAC, 100% lease, 10-year leases. That was almost like a 9 cap. I'm like, what am I missing?
You saw the prices unreasonably skyrocketing in multifamily for no reason. Because, by the way, you have a lot of syndicators out there that are buying, that are overpaying. They're driving the cap rates down, which drives the prices up. And so while others were greedy, you're like, I'm going to take advantage of everybody else being greedy. And I'm going to exit at compressed cap rates at high values. And I'm going to go into something that's getting beat up for no good reason. The values of this retail triple net's getting beat up. I understand, like, yeah, COVID, you know, the world's going to end, all the stores are going to go out of business. And you say, and you're like, man, I'm looking at this property. These guys are doing just fine operating at a 9 cap. So you sell at a 4 cap and buy at a 9 cap. Did I paraphrase that right? Or
that's a fair paraphrase. Yeah. It was a mixture of luck, a little bit of smarts, and just good timing, dude. And then I just went absolute balls to the freaking wall with it. I was selling 1500 units. And I bought retail that was, you know, 3 times the size of my multifamily portfolio. So, jeez. I mean, dude, it was freaking crazy.
Can we back up to how you sold those 1500 units? Did you package them up as a portfolio? Did you sell them individually? Did you sell them all in just 1031 into one big deal? What did the sell of those look like? Because I know maybe at the time it was easy to sell those multifamilies, but sometimes it's not easy when that's spread out over 3 states and multiple properties.
So it was a lot of individual transactions. I sold my best properties to my friend, and the other ones I sold off to random groups and stuff like that.
How are those properties doing that you sold to your friend? You doing okay?
He's doing really good. We're looking to buy more. I don't want to run him. I said, I'll invest with you, man, as long as you run him. But he's a great, great, great operator. So we're going to try to milk it while he still has energy in his bones to continue running. But he owns 500 units, trying to get more. So
I'm in Wisconsin right now, and I see all these restaurants or like commercial retail or whatever. And I'm looking at these things saying the same thing. I'm like, what am I missing? Like, some of these have pretty long-term leases, and there's one down the street that's got a 9 cap. Having this conversation with you, I'm like, man, maybe I need to go relook at these. Well, at these assets,
you're not getting yeah, man, with inflation and expenses going up, like, and if you're maintaining toilets and roofs and HVAC, like, Gabe's made the switch to industrial triple net. So, I mean, I love that. And you can control your expenses. I'm curious, like, are things still trading at 9 caps, or is caps compressing in the triple net space? What sort of assets do you own? Are they strip malls? Are they, like, maybe elaborate on your current portfolio a little bit and what the market looks like currently? Cause I literally don't know anything about this stuff right now.
Yeah. I'm in, I think, 6 states. I think I have 10 or 11 properties. I mean, my tenants are like Ross, TJ, Hobby, Best Buy, Dollar Tree. That's most of them. I have some smaller shadow anchors next to like a Walmart or a grocery store. But most of them are big box with some little small shops next to it. My portfolio is probably 98% occupied. Everything is excellent, man. I'm probably dealing with 3 or 4 or 5 leases right now. One tenant moves out, I can find somebody else, but it's excellent. I'm looking for more.
Do you need property management or is it triple net? You do? Okay.
Triple net is a vague term. If you want true triple net, you want to buy a single tenant building like a Chick-fil-A or a Walgreens. Because what my stuff does not cover is like roof replacement and parking lot replacement. And almost all my people have caps on how much I can charge them for common area maintenance. It's a complicated triple net language, but usually they'll cover their taxes and insurance, which is pretty big. Another good reason I'm in triple net is it's a fraction of a fraction of how damaging it is for the multi, especially on the Gulf Coast or any kind of waterfront stuff. My retail stuff is fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what multifamily is, from dollar to dollar.
Well, it seems like they'd be more respectful to these businesses because they want their businesses nice. It's different than like a Class C apartment complex.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
What about lending on triple net? It seems like also, and again, I'm speculating that banks seem to like this stuff better. You're underwriting tenants, you're underwriting Best Buy, you're running, you know, so lending seems to be a little easier, and lenders also seem to be a little more creative. And I'm just saying that just by knowing what Gabe has done with his stuff.
100%. If you can show a tenant that it's publicly traded, you can see their financials, and dude, they love it. They can put in their file, so when they get audited, it just makes them look that much better and that much stronger. But yeah, I mean, all my loans were with regional banks. They gave me some, and I bought all this during COVID when rates were in the 3s and 4s. They gave me the most incredible debt I could ever imagine. I mean, my average loan right now, I'm at about 4% until 2027. So really good stuff.
What's the end goal? Like, you're doing, like, it's in your bio, so I'm going to say you're making 7 figures annual cash flow, which, like, what are you doing? What's the end goal? Are you going to hold the portfolio you have now? Are you going to keep scaling because you like it? Or do you not know and you're just having fun?
I'm a deal junkie at heart, you know? I love doing deals. That's what excites me. I don't like I said, everything I have is third-party managed. They deal with all the crap and the financials and the reconciliations and all that. I love talking to banks. I love talking to brokers. I like analyzing deals. And I'll never stop doing that. But, you know, I'm not a fund. I'm not a syndication. So I don't have this pressure to buy something. So my goal was and still is to do 1 to 3 deals a year. But I don't want to do any small deals. So, yeah, that's my goal. I mean, I have a great quality of life, but I still love to do deals. I mean, I was analyzing a offering memorandum right before we got on this call. So I'm trying to do some deals, man. But I didn't do anything for 13 months. I tried and I couldn't get any deals done. I did my first deal in January after 13 months.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we didn't buy anything for a year and a half. And now we just closed on a 50 unit. We've got another 90 unit portfolio in contract. So, like, deals are coming back. My personal thesis is the environment hasn't changed. I think buyers or sellers that are in pain are just tired of being in pain. And they're ready to just, like, exit. And they're starting to align. They're starting to align their expectations closer to the buyer. So,
you know, one thing, Ryan, your story is very inspiring. You know, hearing your story when we spent some time in Wyoming together, it was very interesting to me because, you know, I built up a multifamily portfolio, some mixed use stuff, but about a third of the size of, you know, I have under 500 units, about 450 units of multifamily. And as I've shifted into the commercial space, I've been buying mostly triple net industrial deals. And then I meet you and I hear about you build up this, you know, 1500 multifamily portfolio. And I remember, like, when I first heard your story, I loved your willingness to just go all in and shift on asset classes, because I watch a lot of real estate investors, you know, they want to be the single family expert or the multifamily expert. And, you know, it's interesting to me because you didn't let yourself get pigeonholed into like, hey, I'm the multifamily guy, or I need to syndicate or raise capital to necessarily grow my portfolio. You literally sold every, and it wasn't the first time you sold every, your initial portfolio when you moved. And then you built an even larger portfolio and sold that and went all in commercial properties. And I love what you said about you're not focused on a bunch of deals. You're focused on, you want to take down a couple deals, but they're going to be big deals. And I've really shifted my mindset with that as well, where it used to be, I want to buy as many deals as possible. And now I look at it through a very different lens of like, I don't need to do as many deals as I can. What I want to do is bigger, more financially impactful deals. And I love hearing the parallel to your story, because you're doing that exact thing. You sold your entire portfolio. You didn't allow yourself to get stuck in this, like, I'm just a multifamily investor. And you completely shifted asset classes and have found a ton of success in this triple net space. And I just want to say it's very, very inspirational. And I hope our listeners get a ton out of it, because your story, it absolutely fascinated.
Yeah. I mean, dude, like, I'm agnostic to real estate at the end of the day. I would buy all the industrial in the world if I can make the numbers make sense. And again, I don't have the knowledge of it. I'd buy all the multifamily in the world. I'd figure a way to run it, but right now the numbers don't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So I just like to do deals. And the reason I'm doing deals is so I can have a good quality of life. So, I mean, I don't have a website or anything, dude. I mean, I just like to do deals.
I think you hit on that. We're all kind of deal junkies. There's nothing more that I enjoy than like digging into a P&L or rent roll and uncovering an anomalies and finding opportunity and then structuring deals. And there's so many different levers to a deal. Price is one of them, you know, terms, down payment, amortization, interest rate, all those types of things. So you're still buying even with the current rate environment. I mean, you got a lot of good debt locked in. You're just probably a little more judicious on what you're looking
at. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to buy. I just can't make the numbers make sense with the current debt. And I don't want to go to LifeCo or CMBS and like lock up it with a, you know, 7.5 cap whenever I hope the rates drop.
Right.
I mean, if the rates drop, I mean, it's going to be on. So, but seriously, my last deal I did was a loan assumption deal. So I bought it for an 8 cap and that was at 4%. So the numbers made sense to me.
Yeah. So that's great. Awesome. Yeah. A lot of people need to look for creative financing, seller financing, assumable debt, stuff like that. Okay. I have a couple of questions there. This is actually one really good question here from Jennifer. When you sold the properties, when you got married and you had all the cap gains, you've actually sold your portfolio a few times. Yep. Did you 1031 exchange? Did you roll, or did you just pay your capital gains and, you know, bank the cash and then go shopping?
It was one or the other. It was either a 1031, or I made sure whatever I would buy, I could do a nice call seg on it. But no, dude, I am in this real estate train for life. I cannot get out. I'm stuck in it. There's no
way. We're all addicts. We're all real estate addicts.
I love that answer. There's no way out.
For those of you who are listening, what the hell is a 1031 tax deferred exchange? Google it. But basically, you can sell a property and roll the gains into another property without paying the capital gains. It's like deferring capital gains, but like if you never sell property, then you basically kick the can down the road. And then a cost segregation study is basically depreciating the improvements of a property, and you can bonus depreciate some of that stuff really fast. And it's a, man, if you're getting into real estate, understand those two tools, because they are absolutely, absolutely critical. So thanks for answering that. What else, any other questions here? Oh, here's actually another question here. It's like, and this is probably more general, like, is the seller market more sophisticated now that there is more widely available education? Yes and no. I mean, it's like anything. It's an here's my answer, and maybe you guys could chime in. It's an imperfect market. Yeah, you buy from a sophisticated seller that understands what's happening. Great. But there's also like a lot of mom and, at least in some of the stuff we're doing, a lot of mom and pops. There's reasons people need to get out. So yeah, there's a lot more education out there, but like most people, maybe they don't understand that. I don't know, Mitch, Gabe, what'd you guys say? And Ryan too, what's your answer on that?
For me, in my experience, it depends on the price point, you know, zero to a million, different, you know, 1 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 20 different universes. Yeah. Whenever I got to the level that I'm at now buying, you know, the deals, I'm buying $20 million deals. I had to I had to give everything to prove to these sellers and brokers that I'm a real buyer. And that was mainly with non-refundable money and closing. I had to really prove myself. So yeah, you have to really fight when you get to higher price points. No question.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense because people don't want to waste a lot of time on, and there's a lot of tire kickers out there. Don't be a tire kicker. Take action.
Yeah. Yeah, we like to ask a lot of guests this, like a lot of the people listening are starting with very little. And I think that a lot of people use the excuse of money to like to not get started, or they're like, when I have this much, I'll get started. I'll go get a deal when I have this much. So my question to you is like, if you were to start tomorrow, $0 in your pocket, you're sitting on you're sleeping on your buddy's couch or whatever, but you want to scale in real estate, like what's your next move? What does your next 30 days look like?
I would say don't be scared of hearing no, you know,
that's it.
Just, you know, read, think and grow rich. Dude, yep. That, if that's not the point, Bible of the mindset of an entrepreneur, I don't know what it is.
But
just persistence, determination, just don't freaking give up. And if you get told 100 times no, and you'll still learn so much stuff, will be ridiculous. Just don't be scared of being told no.
Ryan, thank you very much for being on. A lot of gems in there. I appreciate you being willing to share your journey with our tribe, and appreciate you very much.
Of course, man.
Yeah, man.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was awesome. Maybe we'll have you back on someday when you're twice as big as you are now, because you're not stopping. Yeah, takeaways. A lot of really cool takeaways. A lot of cool nuggets. I had to go back when we launched this. Go back and listen to this and take notes. Relationships, banking, be savage, be creative. Don't take no for an answer. So for those of you listening, we'll be recording these every Tuesday at noon Pacific Standard Time. Tell your friends, come join the tribe, take the right steps, take action, reach freedom, time freedom. We call that retirement number one. That's R1 at the 0-100 tribe. So for Gabe, Mitch, and myself, we're going to adjourn. So thanks, everybody. We're out.